we would like to send out a special thanks to the fun and challenging Best Fiends, the infamously impossible-to-put-down puzzle game. Download Best Fiends free today on the Apple App Store or Google Play. That's friends without the R, Best Fiends. Thank you, and enjoy the show. January 10th, 1983. Tacoma, Washington. 2-year-old Wallace Giedros is reported missing by his father, Stanley Giedros, who claims that he brought Wallace to a local park and last saw him in the company of an unidentified couple and a young girl. 28 years later, Stanley is charged with an unrelated murder and confesses that he accidentally killed Wallace and disposed of his body. However, Stanley's confession is suppressed by the court, and since the search fails to turn up any trace of Wallace, he continues to remain a missing person. After that, the trail went cold. Hello, everyone, and welcome to our latest episode of The Trail Went Cold. I'm your host, Robin Warder, and today we're going to be exploring two missing children's cases: the 1983 disappearance of 2-year-old Wallace Giedros, and the 1995 disappearance of 3-year-old Lenoria Jones. Over the years, I received separate requests to cover each of these cases, and even though they're not connected, there are a number of similarities between them, so I figured it would be a good idea to feature both of them on today's episode. Wallace and Lenoria were both persons of color who went missing in Tacoma, Washington. The two children were each reported missing by family members who claimed to have lost them in a public place, but the authorities would find discrepancies in their stories to make them believe they were not telling the full truth. In Wallace's case, his own father would be charged with another murder 3 decades later and confess to being responsible for his son's disappearance, but there was no corroborating evidence to prove his confession was true. The circumstances of Lenoria's case are even more bizarre, as she was being raised by her great-aunt, who seemed to be a very loving guardian, yet there are undeniable holes in her story about the circumstances of how Lenoria went missing, so investigators have always suspected her of knowing more than she's revealed. Also, a special shout-out should be given to a Reddit poster under the username QuirkyMotor, who has done extensive write-ups for both these cases at the Unresolved Mysteries subreddit in recent months, and these proved to be very useful resources at helping me research this episode. I'll begin the episode by sharing the details of Wallace and Lenoria's cases before I provide my own theories and analysis for both of them. However, before we get started, just a quick reminder that The Trail Went Cold is a weekly podcast, which is currently available for download on several platforms, including Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Google Podcasts, and Spotify. So if you like this podcast, be sure to subscribe to it, and please leave us a rating or review on any of those sites to help spread the word and garner us more exposure. The Trail Went Cold is on Patreon, so if you would like to learn how to support the show, please visit our page at patreon.com/thetrailwentcold. For as little as $1 a month, you can garner access to exclusive rewards, which may include stickers and thank you cards, early access to episodes, and bonus content. So with all that out of the way, let us now start off by exploring the disappearance of Wallace Giedros. Our first story begins in Tacoma, Washington in 1983. Our first victim is 2-year-old Wallace Giedros, who is the biracial child of his 25-year-old African-American father, Stanley Giedros, and his Korean mother, Chom Giedros. Stanley is a former army soldier who was stationed at Fort Lewis and met his wife during a tour of South Korea, but he is unemployed at this time and lives with his family in an apartment in the suburb of Fife. At 7:42 p.m. on the evening of January the 10th, Stanley called the Tacoma Police Department from the payphone of a tavern at Point Defiance Park in order to report his son missing. Stanley claimed that between 2 and 2:30 that afternoon, he went to the park to go fishing with a pair of family friends and took Wallace along with him. After they fished for about 2 hours, Stanley and his friends went their separate ways, and he took Wallace to a duck pond near the park's entrance. It was here where Wallace started playing with a young Caucasian girl with long blonde hair who appeared to be 2 or 3 years old. Stanley said the girl was accompanied by a Caucasian woman whom he assumed to be her mother, and he would later describe her as being in her early to mid-20s with light blonde shoulder-length hair and long eyelashes. While the children played, Stanley said that he struck up a conversation with a bearded Caucasian man whom he believed was this girl's father. He described him as being in his late 20s or early 30s and around 6 feet tall with a medium build and shoulder-length sandy brown hair which was covered by a baseball cap. According to Stanley, the man pulled a beer out of his backpack and handed it to him, and since Stanley figured the girl's mother would be able to watch over Wallace, he decided to go for a walk with this man down the park's trails towards a waterfall. Stanley said that they drank beer together while discussing such topics as how bad the economic situation in Tacoma was at that time. However, when the two men returned to the duck pond about 25 to 40 minutes later, Stanley claimed that Wallace, the girl, and the woman were gone. Stanley and the bearded man agreed to split up and search the park for them, but after they went their separate ways, Stanley never saw the man again. After searching for nearly 2 hours, he could find no trace of Wallace or the two females, so he went to a payphone to call the police. An extensive search would be performed of the 700-acre park, which involved volunteers, helicopters, tracking dogs, and divers. Even after the duck pond was drained, Wallace could not be found. Stanley agreed to undergo hypnosis in order to help provide more detailed descriptions of the man and woman he had seen, and this allowed police to put together composite sketches for them. Even after the sketches were circulated throughout the area, neither the couple nor the girl who had been with them could be identified, though the police would receive an interesting anonymous phone call from a woman. She claimed she had been at Port Defiance Park with her own children on the same day Wallace went missing, and saw a man and woman matching the description of the couple who had been seen with Wallace. The woman said the couple made 2 separate attempts to abduct her kids, but her story was never verified, and this did not lead the authorities any closer to finding Wallace. The situation seemed to take an enormous toll on Stanley and Chom Guidroz, who divorced 2 years after their son went missing. Chom subsequently moved to Illinois, but passed away in 1995 at the age of 37. Stanley moved back to his home state of Louisiana and got married to a woman named Papetra in 2003. But her relatives would describe the marriage as being tumultuous, as Stanley was supposedly jealous and abusive towards her. He was also known for being a drug user, and was arrested in Louisiana on multiple occasions for various drug and theft charges. At around 5 a.m. on March the 9th, 2011, Stanley and Papetra were sitting together inside Papetra's Ford Mustang, which was parked behind a Burger King restaurant in the town of Houma. Papetra had recently taken Stanley back following a separation, but the couple got into a heated argument, which escalated into Stanley stabbing his wife multiple times in the head and neck. Stanley then reportedly spent the next 7 hours aimlessly driving around with his wife's body in the back seat, before he finally stopped at police headquarters in the town of Zachary, over 100 miles away. He proceeded to turn himself in and showed the police his wife's body before he made a full confession about what he did. In August of 2012, Stanley would agree to plead guilty to second-degree murder and received a sentence of life imprisonment at the Louisiana State Penitentiary at Angola. Well, needless to say, the publicity surrounding Papetra's murder brought Wallace's case back into the spotlight. Investigators revealed that due to some inconsistencies in his original story, they had never ruled out Stanley as a suspect. A couple who knew Wallace prior to his disappearance said they often saw him with injuries, bruises, and black eyes, and that Stanley would sometimes drop Wallace off at the residence and disappear for days at a time. Police had also uncovered a Child Protective Services report from 1982, in which they investigated a head injury Wallace had suffered, though Stanley told a caseworker it was the result of Wallace accidentally pulling a cord, which caused an iron to fall off an ironing board and strike him in the head. A cold case detective with the Tacoma Police Department decided to travel to Louisiana to re-interview Stanley in prison. He was interviewed multiple times and kept giving different versions of his original story until he finally broke down and made a full confession to causing Wallace's death. Stanley claimed that he did take Wallace to Point Defiance Park to go fishing that afternoon, but his story about the couple and the girl were completely fabricated. Instead, Stanley took Wallace back to their apartment and put him in his high chair to feed him until Wallace started, quote-unquote, acting fussy. This prompted Stanley to angrily lash out and backhand Wallace, which caused him to accidentally fall out of his chair and hit his head on the floor. Once Stanley realized his son was dead, he took Wallace's body to an area located near Tacoma's waterfront and buried him in a shallow grave. He then subsequently went to a payphone and called the police to report Wallace missing and provided them with a fake story. Stanley said that the burial spot was located along Ruston Way, approximately 4 miles from Point Defiance Park, but even though a dig was performed at this location with cadaver dogs and radar equipment, nothing was found. The spot had been converted into a public park 3 years after Wallace originally went missing, so the land may have been moved or upturned. Forensic anthropologists stated that even if Wallace had been buried there, the soil and moisture, combined with the boy's size and young age at the time, made it unlikely his remains would ever be recovered. However, investigators still believe that Stanley's confession was genuine, and the medical examiner's office would even issue an official death certificate for Wallace, listing his death as a homicide caused by blunt force injury to the head. In September of 2014, Stanley was extradited from Louisiana to Washington, where the Pierce County prosecuting attorney charged him with first-degree manslaughter. However, when Stanley appeared in Pierce County District Court 5 months later, he pled not guilty to the charge after seemingly recanting his confession. Stanley's defense team moved to dismiss the case because of a Washington law known as the Corpus Delicti Rule, which requires prosecutors to present other evidence besides a confession if they want to prove that a crime has occurred. In July of 2015, a Superior Court judge ruled to suppress Stanley's confession and dismiss the manslaughter charge, stating that there was no evidence besides Stanley's own statements to support the prosecution's case. Stanley continues to remain in prison for the murder of his wife, but his alleged role in his son's death has never been corroborated, and Wallace is still missing. So I guess you could say, the trail went cold. So now let's move on to our next case. Our second story begins in Washington State in 1995, and our second victim is 3-year-old Lenoria Jones. Lenoria is an African-American child who was originally born in Spokane, but her biological mother, Deidre Jones, struggled with drug addiction and used drugs during her pregnancy, so Lenoria was born with cocaine in her bloodstream. Since Deidre was deemed unfit to take care of her daughter, and the identity of Lenoria's biological father was unknown, the child would spend the first 2 years of her life living in foster care and with various relatives before Deidre's legal parental rights were terminated. While Lenoria's maternal grandparents in Spokane were interested in adopting her, Deidre personally recommended that the child be placed in the care of Lenoria's 45-year-old great-aunt, Burlene Williams, a former Sunday school teacher who lived with her son and 3 daughters on South Sheridan Avenue in the Hilltop neighborhood of Tacoma, and she also ran a daycare from her home. Burlene looked after Lenoria for about a year and was in the process of legally adopting her through a private agency. However, at 9:42 a.m. on the morning of July the 20th, Burlene phoned the Tacoma Police Department from a Target department store on South 23rd Street to report Lenoria missing. She claimed that she took Lenoria inside the store, but at some point, they became separated, and Burlene could not find her anywhere. At first, the police did not have any reason to question Burlene's story, but when they checked the store's security tape, they found surveillance footage of Burlene walking through the front entrance alone. Lenoria was not with her, and there did not appear to be any footage of the child inside the store at all. Furthermore, it would turn out that Burlene had placed a call to her home at 8:47 that morning from a payphone at a 7-Eleven convenience store and told her daughter that she did not know Lenoria's whereabouts. Burlene then visited a few other locations, including a car wash, and made at least one other call to her home sometime between 9:15 and 9:20 before she arrived at the Target store and phoned the police. Berlin was unable to provide any explanation for why she waited 55 minutes after her original call before she reported Lenoria missing. When confronted with the fact that the surveillance footage showed Berlin entering the store without Lenoria, she initially replied, quote, "Well, maybe she wasn't with me." Berlin would be extensively interrogated by the police for 10 hours and wound up changing her story on numerous occasions. At various points, she claimed that Lenoria had wandered away from her home, had been abducted from the Target parking lot, was kidnapped by two unidentified black men near the residence, or was safe and living at an undisclosed location. Detectives said that whenever Berlin shared one of her stories, she would get to a certain point and then abruptly stop talking. On July the 23rd, 3 days after Lenoria originally went missing, Berlin's family held a press conference outside her house, and one of her daughters read a statement containing the latest version of Berlin's story. Berlin now claimed that she was walking through the parking lot towards the Target store with Lenoria when Lenoria said she wanted to get a new toy. Berlin responded by saying that she needed to get a bathing suit for herself, but after she finished, they could go look at the toy section. Berlin then said that she heard Lenoria reply okay before she walked into the store, but claimed that she never actually turned her head to check if Lenoria was behind her. It was not until after she grabbed a cart and walked into the sections with the bathing suits when Berlin noticed that Lenoria was no longer with her and she could not find the child anywhere in the store. So if Lenoria had wandered off, or something happened to her in the parking lot before she reached the store's entrance and Berlin never noticed, this would account for why Lenoria never showed up in any of the surveillance footage. While police asked Berlin and her children to take polygraph tests, they all declined to do so. Investigators learned that the last confirmed sighting of Lenoria from anyone outside her family was when she was seen at church on July the 16th, 4 days before she was reported missing. In addition, her birth mother, Deidre, who was now living in Arkansas, told police that she had called Berlin's residence 2 days before Lenoria's disappearance and asked to speak with her daughter, but Berlin would not let her. Since Lenoria was still technically a ward of the state, the Department of Social and Health Services suspended Berlin's daycare license. A juvenile court commissioner would find Berlin in contempt of a civil order which had placed Lenoria in her home. Since Berlin refused to produce Lenoria or reveal where she was, she would be placed under house arrest. Berlin's coin-appointed attorney appealed the decision, claiming that the only reason she kept changing her statements was because she had become nervous and distraught due to the constant badgering from law enforcement. The attorney pointed out that Berlin had no criminal record and accused the police of ignoring other avenues of investigation. After Berlin spent 4 months under house arrest, a Pierce County juvenile court judge finally decided to lift it, ruling that it had been proven that Berlin had intentionally withheld information about Lenoria. Berlin eventually moved to Spokane, but has not given any interviews to the media since 1995. Investigators ruled out most of Lenoria's relatives, including her birth mother and her maternal grandparents, as suspects, but they said they could not rule out Berlin. In 2006, the Washington State Patrol and the carrier Gordon Trucking launched the Homeward Bound program, in which the photographs of 15 missing children would be displayed on the sides of Gordon trucks in order to raise awareness of their cases, and one of the featured children was Lenoria. Even though she was only 3 years old, Lenoria had already been diagnosed with attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, also known as ADHD, and in the days prior to her disappearance, she was prescribed a tricyclic antidepressant called norpramin to control the condition. Since this drug is not ordinarily prescribed to young children, one theory which has been pushed forward is that Lenoria could have overdosed or suffered a fatal reaction to the drug, prompting Berlin to dispose of her body in order to cover up the whole thing, but no evidence has ever been found to support this theory. In 2015, the Tacoma Police Department's cold case detective, Lindsay Wade, announced that in August of 1995, an anonymous tipster called 911 and provided new information about the case which was not known to the public and could have been very helpful to the investigation. While she did not provide any specific details about this information, Detective Wade made it very clear that she really wanted the anonymous caller to come forward, stating, quote, "This person could be the key to solving this case if their information is correct," end quote. However, after nearly 26 years, there are still no answers about what actually happened to Lenoria Jones. So I guess you could say, the trail went cold. But before we continue, I would like to take a moment to talk about our sponsor, Best Fiends. Summer has finally arrived, and even though it's been a rough year and a half, I'd like to think that things might be getting back to normal. I'm particularly looking forward to doing activities I haven't been able to do for quite some time, such as attending a baseball game, watching a movie in a theater, or, most importantly, attending podcasting events and meetups again. There is a possibility this summer will almost be normal, which, as it turns out, is super refreshing. And if you want your brain to feel like it's summertime all the time, download Best Fiends. Trust me, Best Fiends was a godsend last summer when I was cooped up indoors and couldn't do much of anything, but it was a good way to keep my brain refreshed when I couldn't do the traditional summertime activities. Once you start playing Best Fiends, you don't want to stop, and having spare time to play it this past year allowed me to make major progress on the game, and I recently made it to level 1600. Best Fiends is way more fun than the other matching puzzle games out there, and while playing it, 30 minutes can feel like 30 seconds. It's totally free to download, and the adorable collectible characters just keep coming. Best Fiends releases new challenges, characters, and themes all the time, just to keep you on your toes. There's just so much to love about this game, so give it a try, and let me know if you love it as much as I do. So download Best Fiends free today on the Apple App Store or Google Play. That's friends without the R, Best Fiends. Give it a try. Thank you, and enjoy the rest of this episode. So here we have two cold cases involving missing children, where suspicion has been cast upon their guardian, but the circumstances of how these cases played out are quite different. If you look through the original press coverage of Wallace Giedros' disappearance, his father Stanley comes across as a pretty believable grieving father, and if the police had any misgivings about his original story, they never publicly said so at that time. However, in the case of Lenoria Jones, it's pretty obvious that the police had issues with the story provided by her great aunt, Berline Williams, right from the very beginning. Obviously, Stanley Giedros would be portrayed in a much worse light decades later when he was charged with murdering his wife and confessed to killing Wallace. While I did not believe this was public knowledge back in 1983, it looks like there were stories about Stanley having mistreated his son prior to his disappearance. But this is a sharp contrast to Berline Williams, because even after she was placed under a cloud of suspicion, I have never heard one story about her mistreating Lenoria or any of her own kids. In fact, until Lenoria went missing, it sounds like Berline was a model citizen whose entire life was centered around taking care of children, and you get the impression that she genuinely loved Lenoria and wanted to legally adopt her. Berline certainly does not fit the profile of someone you would expect to harm a child, and I have no idea what her potential motive could have been, yet I cannot overlook the major discrepancies in her story from the day Lenoria went missing. While we know that Stanley Giedros is going to remain locked up for the rest of his life, Berline Williams has pretty much stayed completely out of the spotlight for the past 25 years, and I have no idea what she's up to today. But before we talk about Lenoria's case any further, let's discuss the circumstances of how Wallace Giedros went missing. I believe I first became familiar with Wallace's case after stumbling upon his profile page at the Charlie Project in around 2009 or 2010. At that time, Stanley had not yet been arrested for killing his wife, and there was nothing in the write-up to indicate he was considered a suspect in his son's disappearance, but I still thought that something was off about his story. I try to avoid being judgmental about the actions of parents of missing children, particularly when dealing with older cases such as this, as the world was a much different place back in 1983, and parents were a lot less protective of their kids. However, if Stanley's story was true, his actions seemed pretty irresponsible for someone who was taking care of a 2-year-old. As you recall, Stanley claims that Wallace started playing near the duck pond with a young girl who was accompanied by a woman who appeared to be her mother. Stanley then started up a conversation with a man whom he assumed was the girl's father, and they spent the next 25 to 40 minutes walking around the park drinking beer until he returned to discover that Wallace was missing. I mean, I'm not saying that Stanley needed to be a helicopter parent or anything, but I don't think you'll find too many people who would feel comfortable with the idea of leaving their child next to a body of water for that length of time with strangers they don't even know, even if there is another child present. I also found it suspicious that even though Stanley was able to provide a detailed description of this man he supposedly conversed with, he never actually learned his name. I must admit that even though I found Stanley's story to be unbelievable, my initial impression was not that he necessarily caused his son's disappearance, but that he may have been lying about certain details in order to cover up some negligent behavior on his part. Perhaps Stanley left Wallace alone for a period of time in order to do something like score some drugs, which is when he was abducted, but in order to avoid telling the complete truth about this, Stanley fabricated a story about a non-existent couple and a little girl. To be fair, there was one anonymous female caller who seemed to corroborate Stanley's account, since she claimed she saw a couple matching that description in the park that very same afternoon, and they tried to grab her children. After hearing that, you could assume the couple was using the young blonde girl to lure other children for them to kidnap. But assuming that the anonymous call wasn't a hoax, I guess an alternate explanation is that this woman legitimately did remember seeing a couple in the park that day, but exaggerated the details of her story. She could have seen the composite sketches of this man and woman in the newspapers, and once she read they were potentially involved in the abduction of a child, she may have convinced herself that they attempted to go after her children. Likewise, it's also possible that Stanley saw a couple matching this description in the park that afternoon and used them as the basis for his fictitious story, and then just got really lucky when another independent eyewitness also recalled seeing them. If Stanley was responsible for Wallace's disappearance, the way he handled things by fabricating an elaborate cover story is in sharp contrast to how he handled the murder of his wife, Petra, in 2011. In that case, Stanley made no attempt to get away with it, as he literally drove around for hours with his wife's body inside the car before he turned himself in at a police station. But if he was carrying a lot of guilt about what happened to Wallace, perhaps Stanley finally decided he needed to face punishment. It's interesting to read some of the original newspaper articles from 1983, which mentioned that Stanley had to be taken to the hospital after overdosing on some pills only 2 days after Wallace went missing. While the overdose was reported as being accidental at the time, knowing what we know now, you have to wonder if this was a suicide attempt. Of course, committing second-degree murder is an automatic life sentence in Louisiana, so regardless of what happens with Wallace's case, Stanley is never getting out of prison. After confessing to Wallace's death, you might be wondering why Stanley ultimately decided to plead not guilty to the manslaughter charge when he had nothing left to lose, but he did openly express his fear about being labeled as a child killer. Remember, people who harm children are considered to be the lowest of the low in prison, so pleading guilty to killing his own son could make Stanley's life sentence a lot more difficult. While there were other witnesses who claimed that Stanley was abusive and neglectful towards Wallace prior to his disappearance, the court stated that this only proved Stanley was a bad parent, not that he committed manslaughter. So there really isn't any evidence against Stanley besides his own confession, which has been suppressed. The state tried to appeal this decision, and if you search online, you can find the opinion from 2016 where the state of Washington Supreme Court upheld the ruling. Oddly, the opinion stated that Stanley's defense team had alleged that the FBI once filed an application for a search warrant because they had information that the boyfriend of Wallace's mother, Chom Guidroz, traveled to Tacoma and abducted Wallace and took the boy to Texas to be with him and Chom. I wish I had more information about this so-called boyfriend, because even though Stanley and Chom divorced 2 years after Wallace went missing, Does this mean she was already having an affair with this man in 1983? When Wallace disappeared, Chom did not talk much to the media because she spoke very little English, but it's too bad that she passed away years later, because I definitely would be interested in hearing her perspective of what Stanley was like at that time and if he mistreated their son. But without knowing anything about Chom's boyfriend, I don't think I'll put much stock into this alternate scenario of him abducting Wallace. When you look at all the facts of this case, Stanley being the responsible party really does make the most sense. Now, it sounds like the first part of Stanley's story is actually true, as a pair of family friends did corroborate that they all took Wallace fishing at Port Defiance Park on that particular afternoon. However, these friends parted ways with Stanley at around 4:30 or so, and until Stanley called the police at 7:42, it does not sound like there were any other independent eyewitness sightings of Wallace. Stanley tried to account for this 3-hour window by claiming that he spent the first part hanging out with the unidentified bearded guy, but after they separated, Stanley said he spent the next 2 hours searching for Wallace on his own before he called the police from a payphone. Well, 2 hours does seem like an awful lot of time to be searching for your missing child alone without seeking help, especially when you consider that this was January and it would have gotten dark right around the time Wallace went missing. So I think there's a good chance that Stanley waited so long to call the police because he needed that time to cover something up. The story Stanley provided during his confession was that he took Wallace home, placed him in his high chair to feed him, and lost his temper when the child started acting out, which prompted Stanley to backhand Wallace and accidentally kill him by knocking him off the chair onto the floor. After burying Wallace's body near the waterfront, Stanley came up with his story about the couple and a young girl before he went back to the park to use a payphone to report his son's disappearance. While 3 hours is not a large window of time for these events to play out and Stanley to dispose of his son's body, it's certainly possible this could have happened. However, even if Stanley did kill Wallace, I would question whether his version of events is the truth. While thousands of kids are injured from falling out of high chairs every year, only a very small percentage of them are actually killed by this. So this may have been a case where Stanley wanted to confess, but twisted the story in order to make it sound like his son's death was some sort of freak accident caused by him momentarily losing his temper. If the stories of Wallace being seen with bruises and injuries, and Stanley being openly hostile towards his child are true, then I fear the actual circumstances of Wallace's death were a lot worse. Regardless, even if Stanley was telling the truth about the location where he buried Wallace, it sounds like investigators do not believe his remains were recoverable after all this time. Unless other corroborating evidence emerges, then I don't believe Stanley will ever be prosecuted for this crime. If he was the guilty party, then at least we can take comfort in knowing that he will never be a free man again, so in that sense, justice was ultimately served. But it would still be nice if Wallace's remains were recovered someday, and the authorities could completely close this case by giving him a proper burial. So now let's move on to Lenoria Jones' disappearance, which, in my opinion, has a lot more ambiguity. The circumstances of Lenoria's life are so tragic because she was born with cocaine in her system because of her mother's drug addiction, and I'm not sure anyone ever determined the identity of her father. But before she went missing, Lenoria did seem to be on the path to living a stable life in a loving home, because as someone who had 4 children and ran her own daycare, Burleen Williams fit the profile of an ideal caregiver for a troubled child. If you've seen the photo of Lenoria on her missing poster, it's a professional portrait in which she's smiling and has her hair braided, so it does look like she was being well cared for until she went missing. Like I mentioned earlier, I have not heard one allegation about Burleen having abused or mistreated her own children or any of the kids she watched over in her daycare, but that doesn't change the fact that the Target store surveillance footage completely contradicts Burleen's story about Lenoria's disappearance. Even though she changed her story several times when being questioned by police, it seems like the version she finally settled on was that Lenoria was with her when they walked through the parking lot towards the store, but Burleen never actually looked behind her to check on Lenoria until long after she went inside. So if something happened to Lenoria before she reached the front entrance, such as her wandering off or being abducted, and Berline did not notice, then this would account for why Lenoria never showed up in the surveillance footage. However, this story is not particularly believable, as I'm sure most people with a 3-year-old would hold onto their hand or at least keep their eyes on them when walking through a parking lot. The surveillance footage did confirm that Lenoria never attempted to look behind her when she entered the store, which seems pretty unusual for someone who is supposed to be accompanying a small child. And another issue is that Berline phoned her daughter from a convenience store nearly 1 hour earlier to say she didn't know where Lenoria was, which contradicts her own claim that she was speaking to Lenoria while they were walking through the Target parking lot. No matter which story Berline provided, there didn't seem to be any version which did not contain a number of discrepancies. At the very least, it sounds like she was hiding something, but if she made Lenoria disappear, what could her motive have been? I mean, given that Lenoria had already been diagnosed with ADHD, I'm sure she was not the easiest child to take care of, but it sounds like Berline was lobbying really hard to adopt Lenoria, and if she had changed her mind, the child's maternal grandparents would have been more than happy to take her instead. The last independent eyewitness sighting of Lenoria from anyone outside Berline's family were from people who saw her at church on June the 16th, 4 days before she was reported missing, though it doesn't sound like they noticed anything unusual about her. And we also have the account from Lenoria's biological mother, who claimed she phoned Berline's residence on June the 18th, but was told she could not speak with Lenoria. So theoretically, anything could have happened to Lenoria during this 4-day window before Berline decided to fabricate a cover story about losing her inside a department store to account for her disappearance. But if the whole thing was staged, why would Berline call her daughter from the convenience store 55 minutes earlier to say that Lenoria was missing? Why not just call the police from that store and tell them that Lenoria disappeared from there? In online discussions about this case, one of the alternate theories which has been presented is that one of Berline's own children could have been responsible for Lenoria's disappearance. So Berline staged this whole thing in order to cover for them. According to the Department of Social Health and Services, the only complaint Berline's daycare ever received concerned her 19-year-old daughter. While the specific details about this complaint were never released, it sounds like it was resolved when Berline agreed to supervise her daughter directly and not leave her in charge. Of course, I don't have any information about Berline's children, so I'm not going to outright accuse them of doing something to Lenoria, and if they did cause the child's death, it may have been the result of negligence rather than anything malicious. Remember, the police specifically said that the sighting of Lenoria in the church on July the 16th was the last time she was confirmed to be alive by anyone outside Berline's family, so perhaps some sort of cover-up did take place. However, it's been nearly 26 years since Lenoria went missing, and it does seem surprising that Berline and her 4 children could all keep their mouths shut for that long. It seems like one of the most prevalent theories is that Lenoria could have overdosed on Norpramin, a medication she had been prescribed for her ADHD only days before she went missing. 3 years old is still relatively young for a child to be diagnosed with ADHD, but considering that she was already born with drugs in her bloodstream, I'm sure these were extraordinary circumstances. I did some research on Norpramin, and it looks like it is primarily used for the treatment of depression, but it is described as being potentially useful to treat symptoms of ADHD. It has also been used for the treatment of cocaine dependency, though there is little evidence of its effectiveness for that. Today, the medication is approved for adults aged 18 years or older, and while a doctor may prescribe it to someone younger, it is not recommended for children. Some of the potentially serious side effects of Norpramin include skin rash, seizures, or even death, which can occur during the first few days of starting the medication. I seriously doubt it would be prescribed for someone as young as 3 years old today, but back in 1995, there may have been less of an understanding of the drug's potential dangers. Unfortunately, there aren't many specific details available about how or why the decision was made for Lenoria to start taking Norpramin, but the sources, including the Charlie Project, state that the medication was prescribed to her. If Berlin had decided on her own accord to give Norpramin to Lenoria, and the child wound up overdosing, then yes, I could see her deciding to dispose of Lenoria's body and orchestrate a cover-up. But if the medication was legally prescribed by a doctor, and Berlin was just following instructions, why go to these lengths? As a daycare provider, perhaps Berlin felt that losing a child on her watch would seriously damage her reputation and destroy her livelihood, as no one would ever allow her to supervise their children again. However, because she provided such an unbelievable story about Lenoria's disappearance, Berlin's daycare was shut down by the state anyway. I know that people can make bad, illogical decisions when they're panicking or under a great deal of stress, but if Lenoria's death was the result of something which wasn't Berlin's fault, I don't know why someone who seemed like such an otherwise responsible care provider would go to such lengths to cover the whole thing up and potentially face jail time. I just feel like these actions would require something a lot more serious than an accidental overdose on medication. During my intro, I made reference to a post about this case on the Unresolved Mystery subreddits, and looking through the comments, it seems like opinions are sharply divided, and there were some interesting points about how the inconsistencies in Berlin's story may have been greatly exaggerated by law enforcement and the media. Berlin claimed that the reason she kept changing her story was because of the pressure of being constantly badgered by the police. Berlin happened to live in Tacoma's Hilltop neighborhood, which was considered to be the most dangerous neighborhood in the city because it had been overrun with drugs and gang activity during the 1980s and early 1990s. So perhaps when this African-American woman from Hilltop reported a child missing, and the police found aspects of her story to be unbelievable, they developed tunnel vision and started thinking she was responsible without looking at other possible angles, even though there was nothing in Berlin's background to suggest she was a criminal. But I don't know. There are just too many murky and unexplained details about this case for me to draw a definitive conclusion. It sounds like the key to this case might be the anonymous phone call which came into 911 in August of 1995, where the caller apparently provided exclusive information which could have blown the case wide open. I cannot imagine what this person might have said, and if it pointed towards or away from Berlin, but we have one detective who has gone on the record and said this case could be solved if this person came forward. Unfortunately, so much time has passed that I'm not sure this person is even aware of how valuable their information might be. If I knew what this caller shared, I might have a better idea of what really happened in this case. As of now, I have no idea how a 45-year-old woman with a history of caring for children could suddenly become complicit in the disappearance of a 3-year-old, but at the same time, I also cannot overlook the fact that actual videotape evidence contradicts her original story. So overall, I am completely perplexed. All that being said, if you have any information on the disappearances of Wallace Guidroz or Lenoria Jones, or you happen to be the aforementioned anonymous caller from 1995, please contact the Tacoma Police Department at 253-798-4721. That's 253-798-4721. But if you just have your own thoughts about what happened, feel free to leave me a comment or send me an email to robin.warder@icloud.com. That's robin.warder@icloud.com. Now the reminder that The Trail Went Cold is on Patreon, so please visit patreon.com/thetrailwentcold to learn how you can support our podcast and become eligible for some pretty neat rewards. We produced a bunch of exclusive bonus episodes for our patrons in tiers 2 and 3, and this past month, I released an episode about the kidnapping of Jo Lynn Rogers, who happened to be the sister of famous professional wrestler Jake the Snake Roberts, and this episode not only examines the crime itself, but the troubling history of Jo Lynn's entire family and her upbringing at the hands of an abusive father. And for our patrons in Tier 3, I've also recorded another new audio commentary track, which can be played over a classic episode of Unsolved Mysteries. I'd also like to give a shout-out to our most recent listeners who have signed up with us on Patreon this week, and they are Sydney P., Vinny M., Gene M., Sean B., Krista B., Michael L., Melanie C., Thomas C., Will and Kat P., and two separate listeners named Kelly M. Thank you all so much for your support. In addition, I want to announce that this coming Saturday, July the 10th at 8 p.m. Eastern Time, we will be holding our next Unsolved Mysteries Live Watch Marathon, where you can join myself and your fellow listeners in our screening room while we view and comment on classic segments from Unsolved Mysteries. We've included a link to our screening room in the show notes for today's episodes, and you can also find them pinned to the top of our social media pages. So once again, our Unsolved Mysteries Live Watch takes place this coming Saturday, July the 10th at 8 p.m. Eastern Time, and we hope to see you there. And before I bring this episode to a close, I'd like to play a promo for the true crime podcast, Murder and Alliance.
Hey y'all, my name is Maggie Freeling. I'm a journalist and producer, and I'm the host of Unjust and Unsolved. And I want to tell you about my new podcast, Murder in Alliance, a real-time investigation into a case that is so bonkers, it's hard to wrap your head around.
Everyone in this town seems to have some kind of secret or interest in this victim, whether it be drugs, sex, or both.
I'll be teaming up with Jason Baldwin from the West Memphis 3 and his organization Proclaim Justice to reinvestigate this murder from the ground in Ohio.
If he slit her throat right here, there would be more blood on that
sofa.
We track down witnesses.
You guys have got to understand what's at risk for me here.
And even uncover massive police corruption.
There were two officers that felt like their brotherhood, their staff, that could have been involved.
This is the case of David Thorne and the murder of Yvonne Lane. Find and follow Murder and Alliance wherever you get your podcasts.
Also, provided that it's safe enough to travel there, The Trail Went Cold is going to be appearing on Podcast Row at the very first CrimeCon UK, which is being held at the Leonardo Royal Hotel and Spa in London on the weekend of September the 25th and 26th. If you would like to purchase tickets to the event, we have a special promo code you can use to get a 10% discount. So to receive 10% off, visit crimecon.co.uk and enter the promo code COLD21. That's COLD21. In addition, I wanted to provide another reminder that I hold live streaming sessions on a platform called Get Vocal. Every Thursday night from 7 until 8 p.m. Eastern Time, I host what is essentially an after show for each week's podcast episode, where I have an interactive discussion about the featured case from said episode and answer questions and address comments from listeners. I always include a link to these sessions in our show notes, so be sure to check there for more information or visit getvocal.com. That's GETVOKL.com. I just wanted to give another shout out to my supporters at the Unsolved Mysteries message board at the Sitcoms Online forum and the Unresolved Mysteries subreddit. And like I just mentioned, the Unresolved Mysteries subreddit contains posts with interesting discussions about both of today's featured cases. I need to provide a big thanks to Miguel Foote, who edits and assembles this podcast together for me, and Vince Nitro, who composes the eerie music you hear on every episode. If you haven't already, you can like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, or leave us a rating or review on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Google Podcasts, or Spotify. So have yourself a good week and join us next Wednesday for another brand new episode of The Trail Went Cold. Thank you.